John Jarvis is the new director of the nation's parks. He'll be in a new role, but not in unfamiliar territory. Mr. Jarvis started with the National Park Service more than three decades ago, handing out maps to tourists on the National Mall during bicentennial celebrations. He is a former park ranger who will now command a veritable army of park rangers. Mr. Jarvis joins us now from Oakland, California, where he's packing up his office as director of the Park Service's Pacific West region and prepares to move to Washington, D.C. Mr. Jarvis, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. I love being on your program.
What do you see as your first priority?
Well, certainly the maintenance backlog is one of our top priorities. The infrastructure of our national parks, as you may be aware, was constructed over the last 100 years, a lot of it many decades old. But that's just one of my priorities. I think there are other challenges and opportunities that are presented for us, for the national park system in these coming years.
I know that you, for example, you oppose the use of snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park. Is that something you'd like to reverse? Can you?
Well, the snowmobile issue in Yellowstone National Park has been an ongoing challenge for several decades, actually, and that we have dueling courts and embedded constituencies on all sides of this issue. I will say that in recent years that there have been significant improvements to the resources in the park and to the experience by the current limitations on the number of snowmobiles and the increased use of snow coaches and the requirements for both best technology and the snow machines themselves, as well as the guiding requirements. All of that has improved both the quality of the experience in terms of sound, mm-hmm. air quality, and effects on wildlife.
Mr. Jarvis, beginning in January, visitors will be allowed to carry guns in national parks, legally registered guns. Do you oppose or support that?
Well, my job as the director of the National Park Service is to implement the laws related to our national parks as passed by Congress and signed by the president. And in this case, it will be my responsibilities to implement that law, which will allow the carrying of both open carry and concealed weapons beginning in January in our national parks. So it's appropriate for me to get to make sure that our park rangers are prepared and well steeped in state law, which really will be the applicable law in these cases, as well as the parks are signed for where you can and in some cases cannot carry the weapon, where we have federal employees operating in federal facilities.
You know, we're following an interview with you, Mr. Jarvis, with a report on someone who's a ranger in Yosemite who left El Salvador at the age of 10 and now is involved in, you know, outreach programs. Would you like to increase the diversity among visitors to our national parks?
Absolutely. I mean, the Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan's film do a very good job of expressing the sort of democratic ideals of the national parks, in that all Americans can stand equally, regardless of their ethnicity or their economic status, shoulder to shoulder and view the Grand Canyon. The problem is that the lineup along the edge of the Grand Canyon does not really reflect the demographic ethnic diversity of this country. I find that to be a problem. Not all Americans are experiencing their national parks. And another one of my priorities is to rebuild that connection between the national parks, both natural and cultural parks, and all Americans.
Mr. Jarvis, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And there's a hardy bush that's been hailed as a great biofuel crop. Jatropha curcus is said to survive in harsh conditions and needs little care. Proponents predict a future in which Jatropha oil will power commercial jets and cars. But in one place where the government has encouraged farmers to plant the bush, things aren't going so well. Nick Wadhams visited a drought-stricken area in Kenya.
The rains have failed for 3 years around here. The earth is bleached dry and dust swirls at the slightest breeze. People are desperate for water and gather here at one of the few boreholes in Kibwezi. Kibwezi's chief, Benson Ngutu, watches as women pour water into yellow jugs strapped to bicycles.
So water is a big problem because of the drought, yeah?
Yeah, no, due to the dryness of the area, now the water has gone far deep in the soil, but we have just a low flow of the water.
But while the drought has put huge pressure on the region, that ought to make Kibwezi perfect territory for Jatropha. The green leafy shrub is said to need little water, and its seeds can be pressed for biofuel oil. Jatropha's chief selling point was that it can grow on land unfit for anything else, so it won't compete with food. That way, it could provide farmers with a cash crop that they could sell. Earlier this decade, Kenya made Jatropha the heart of a 5-year plan to develop a biofuel industry and encouraged farmers to grow the plant on their small plots. Some have had success. That's the sound of waxy, healthy Jatropha leaves at the nearby farm of Boniface Muoki. His farm is seen as a model for Jatropha in the region. Brilliant green plants covered in seeds stand in tidy rows. Muoki's farm is a favorite stopping point for Jatropha advocates trying to win over the skeptics. But he may not be the beacon that he's portrayed to be. Muoki disregarded all the advice about Jatropha and tends his plants fastidiously.
Just like the human body, you have to feed the body, you have to take care of the body, you have to wash, you have to eat good diet to remain healthy. The same for Jatropha.
Muoki's work has paid off. Agricultural officer Festus Mustia looks through a sack of brown, shiny seeds that feel a little oily to the touch.
How do they look, Festus?
Very nice. Very good. They are all, they're healthy greens. Very nice.
However, just up the road from Muoki's success is Wellington Mulwa's 10-acre farm. He also bought into the Jatropha hype. Yet Mulwa's Jatropha plants look more like naked twigs shoved into the ground. He says that 3 years ago, a salesman from Nairobi persuaded him to plant Jatropha and offered to buy the seeds once they bore fruit. He never returned.
He had a big file. And in fact, we talked and he told us how to space. But later, we discovered that the method of planting he had given us was wrong.
In his compound, chickens peck the earth around a lone Jatropha tree. Mulwa planted it a while back and told his wife to throw the dishwater onto it each day. Now it's the only Jatropha shrub that's growing well on his entire farm. Jatropha may not come close to matching the hype. A recent study of 289 farmers by Nairobi-based consultancy Endolevu Energy found yields to be far lower than expected. And so far, there's no market in Kenya for plants that do produce seeds. For now, the farmers of Kibwezi say they're sticking to Jatropha, not necessarily out of hope, but because they've spent lots of money buying the seeds. And they're making so little money anyhow that they can afford to wait and see what happens with the Jatropha in their fields. For NPR News, this is Nick Wadhams in Kibwezi.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Traffic noise and other sounds of city life have taken the romance away for Australia's urban frogs. Air conditioners, jackhammers, generators, they're all drowning out the mating calls of male frogs. And as a result, frog populations are plummeting in the country's urban areas. But there's hope, at least according to a scientist at the University of Melbourne. She says some frogs have figured out a way to work around the human interference in their love lives. From Sydney, Stuart Cohen has the story.
That's the sound of a male southern brown tree frog looking for a date. It's music to the ears of a female southern brown tree frog. But add the sounds of nearby traffic. And Dr. Kirsten Paris of the University of Melbourne says the message just isn't getting out.
The distance over which a male frog can be heard is cut really dramatically by traffic noise, from hundreds of metres in some instances down to maybe only 20 or 50 metres. We're quite concerned that there are frogs out there that aren't getting together because the noise we're making is getting in the way.
So some frogs have come up with an interesting strategy for making themselves heard.
we found that it's changing the pitch of its call, so going higher up the frequency spectrum, being higher and squeakier, further away from the traffic noise, and this increases the distance over which it can be heard.
Here's the old call, and here's the new one. Now that may sound like a pretty simple solution, but changing their calls to cope with a noisy environment is actually quite extraordinary for frogs. And while the males have figured out how to make themselves heard above the noise of the city, Dr. Paris says it may not be what the females are looking for.
When females have a choice between two males calling, they tend to select the one that calls at a lower frequency because in frogs, the frequency of a call is related to body size, so the bigger frogs tend to call lower. And so they also tend to be the older frogs, the guys perhaps with more experience, they know what they're doing, and the women are attracted to those.
In other words, the high talkers typically don't get the girls.
That's right, and if it's very noisy, they can only hear a few of the males that are all calling in a group, so the ones they can choose from, the number is reduced. It's like if you're in a noisy cocktail bar, for example, and there are men everywhere, you can only see and hear the three that are closest to you. You either choose to go with one of them or you spend more energy going to search the room to find someone who looks a little bit more promising. And for females, the longer the time they spend hopping around looking for mates, the more time they're exposed to predators and the more energy they use. So there's a cost to spending a lot of time searching for mates.
Frog populations in Melbourne have dropped considerably in the 7 years since Dr. Paris began her research. It's not just noise that's been the culprit. Climate change has brought a decade of drought to parts of Australia. Since frogs often serve as the environmental canary in a coal mine, Dr. Paris says their demise is worth paying attention to.
Urban habitats are expanding very quickly. At the moment, they only cover about 4% of the Earth's terrestrial surface. And I think the fact that frogs and other animals that communicate acoustically, such as birds, are struggling in urban habitats shows us that the urban habitat is not a healthy place for people either. Noisy places tend to lead to higher stress levels amongst people, a difficulty sleeping, and the quality of life is reduced.
For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
In the next few minutes, we're going to hear about one particular scheme used to encourage industry to lower greenhouse gases. Today, the Senate's Energy Committee hears from economic experts on how much it could cost to curb global warming. It won't be cheap. That's why pending legislation on a climate plan includes a lot of escape clauses designed to ease the pain for industry and consumers. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The model so far for curbing greenhouse gases is the cap-and-trade approach. It works through permits. Think of them as sort of like poker chips. The government gives or sells permits to, say, power companies. A company cashes in a chip when it emits a ton of greenhouse gas. Use up your pile of permits and you've got to buy more. If you don't need all of them, you can sell the extras to another player. Many industries are saying, okay, we can live with that if we can have offsets, too. Offsets are like an extra pile of poker chips that companies can buy at a discount. Michael Wara is an economist at Stanford University who studies offsets.
They induce countries, governments, companies, individuals who are otherwise reluctant to do something about climate change to do something about it because it's in their financial interest. They draw people in.
Let's say you run a power company and you just can't live within your emissions cap. Well, you can pay someone else to reduce their emissions. That could be cheaper than rebuilding your own power plant to emit less carbon dioxide. European companies have been doing this for years. They pay China, for example, to build hydroelectric dams instead of coal plants, or they pay farmers to capture methane from hog waste instead of letting it float up into the atmosphere. But offsets make some people suspicious. They ask how many of these projects really deliver the emission reductions they promise.
The honest answer is we don't know.
Michael Wara again.
They've proven to be very difficult to administer effectively in a way that ensures that they lead to real reductions in emissions.
Here's one of the problems. Let's say a Chinese power company needs a new power plant. They can build a coal plant, which is cheap, or they can build a wind farm, which costs more. If they choose the wind farm, though, they can earn credits. They can sell on the offset market. The idea is that money from polluters will pay for additional green projects that wouldn't have been built otherwise. Trouble is, says Wara, China probably would have built most of those wind farms anyway without the offset money.
China's building a lot of wind farms. All of the wind farms that are being built claim credit as offset projects. And so the question is, would none of those have been built if the offset system didn't exist? I think the real answer is that that can't be right.
The group International Rivers concludes that it's the same with dams. Most have earned offset credits in China, but many would have been built anyway. Europeans are now rethinking their whole offset scheme, but the proposed climate bill in Congress would introduce much the same system here. In fact, the bill allows American industry to buy as much as 2 billion tons of greenhouse gas offset credits. Many of those credits are likely to come from American forests. Trees suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and America has lots of them. But that raises another different problem, something called permanence. Alexia Kelly is a climate analyst with the World Resources Institute in Washington. She supports offsets, but
forests can burn down. They can be prematurely or illegally harvested. We can have a pest or disease outbreak that can kill the biological matter and re-release the carbon. There's a lot of things that can happen.
One way to handle the risk, she says, is to make companies buy extra offset credits, something like insurance, in case their forest goes up in smoke. Kelly acknowledges that an honest offset scheme will take a lot of people and a lot of vigilance.
Are we going to get it completely right all the time? No. But I think that we can ensure that projects that do deserve credit are getting them.
In California, an organization called the Climate Action Reserve has taken the plunge. It's brokering deals between timber owners and polluting companies that want to buy offsets now. Gary Jarrow runs the reserve.
We've gone from, in the last year, 6 projects to 100 projects, and I think it can go to thousands of projects.
Jarrow says the reserve uses a tougher standard than the Kyoto system to make sure offset projects are the real McCoy. Ultimately, says Stanford's Michael Wara, offsets are probably in the cards no matter what.
There's a political compromise in the U.S. that's been drawn between environmental groups and big emitters of greenhouse gases.
That compromise is that to win deep cuts in emissions, Congress has to offer more cheap poker chips to get the game going. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. How energy efficient is your home? Maybe you've weather-stripped your doors or sealed a drafty window, but can you move your walls depending on where the sun is or monitor your electricity usage with your phone? Those are just some of the features on display here in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall. 20 teams are competing in this year's Solar Decathlon. The goal is to design, build, and operate the most attractive, effective, and energy-efficient solar-powered house. And as NPR's David Gura reports, there's efficient, and then there's efficient.
I'm standing on the National Mall just to the east of the Washington Monument. The Capitol building is to my left. And in front of me is a small neighborhood, 20 homes, each of which is really, really energy-efficient.
So this is the Refract House?
Kyle Belcher is standing outside one of the houses, greeting visitors.
This home provides about 150% of its peak energy needs. So on a day like today, we're producing a net surplus of energy and giving energy back into the power grid.
It's a warm fall morning, and the sun is shining. Refract House is tube-shaped. It pivots around a beautiful deck made out of reclaimed elm wood. The roof is filled with solar panels. Its insulation is made out of recycled denim. And every appliance and light fixture is connected to a software program called the Building Dashboard.
From anywhere in the world, when you're on vacation in Hawaii, you can log in online and see how your house is doing in terms of energy usage, energy production, even water usage.
Noah Greer is an architecture student at the California College of the Arts. He says you can use Building Dashboard, which is commercially available, to open and close window shades, to turn lights on and off, and to adjust the house's heating and cooling systems. In North House, another building in the competition, there's a similar interface, integrated into the design. Johnny Rogers, a master's student at Simon Fraser University, shows me a screen built into the kitchen wall. Then he reaches into his pocket and pulls out an iPhone. North House has its own iPhone application. He taps the screen.
You land at a page that provides feedback on your energy consumption and solar energy production.
It's elegant, with bright, colorful graphs, and it's smart.
Your house also provides you with alerts that are sent to your phone so that you can see tips, information on consumption, so that you can adjust your house systems on the fly.
Another house in the Solar Decathlon, called Lumen House, also has a sophisticated computer system and an iPhone app. Incredibly, you can use a smartphone to change how the building looks. On each side of the house, there are giant metal panels. They're programmed to open and close depending on where the sun is in the sky. So if it's a particularly clear night and you want to look out the window at the stars, you can override the system to keep those panels open. Judging in the Solar Decathlon will continue till Friday. David Gura, NPR News.
One part of the real estate market that may be showing promise is green homes, energy-efficient houses that promote a more sustainable lifestyle. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports on one developer in Phoenix, Arizona, that's trying to lure suburbanites to the city with homes that are smaller and closer to mass transit.
The idea that Philip Beer is promoting may seem a bit counterintuitive in a sprawling metropolitan area like Phoenix. In this market, most of the housing stock was built since 1980, and suburban subdivisions advertise amenities like whirlpool tubs and media rooms. But Beer is trying to sell older tract homes in unpolished city neighborhoods.
We have a home from 1957. Not a whole lot's been done to it.
This is a very basic home, even by 1957 standards.
Mm-hmm. Five rooms? Yeah, including the kitchen.
Beer heads a company called Green Street Development, and he's betting that young professionals are tired of commuting into the city from the outskirts of town. So he's bought a couple dozen foreclosed homes at trustee sales, small ranches, 1,400 square feet or so, close to downtown and mass transit. He's renovating them now, making them a bit more modern and a lot more energy efficient. Beer hasn't sold any yet, but he's marketing them mainly to people who live in bigger homes in the suburbs.
It might be someone who works downtown that wants to have a walkable neighborhood. They can walk to the cafe, real cool cafe down the street, or they can walk down to light rail and take it to work or to the ball game, spend more time at home, drive their car less.
That kind of urban living wouldn't be a novelty in cities like Washington or Boston, where there's long been a premium on decent homes near transit lines. But in Phoenix, where land is plentiful and cheap, most development has been in the ever-expanding suburbs. And only in the past year has the city opened its first light rail line. All of Green Street's homes are within a quarter mile of the line, and designer Amy Boubier promotes them as small, sustainable, and economical.
Now, I do see a change happening in that people are downsizing, and they're making smaller spaces more functional. People are less about it trying to impress and more about spaces that function well, that are well-priced, that meet their budget.
Because the homes were foreclosures, the developers say they can sell them below market value, even after the renovations. Most will go for $200,000 to $400,000. You could still get a bigger house in the suburbs for less, but Phoenix real estate economist Elliot Pollack predicts in-town living will appeal to a lot of buyers in an area where the average round-trip commute time is about an hour.
This creates a lifestyle that doesn't exist anywhere else in Phoenix. This allows you to keep your automobile in the garage instead of taking it out every day to commute to work. And so, yes, I think there's definitely a market for this.
Clay Richardson is considering buying one of the renovated homes. With his wife and two children, he now lives in a suburban golf course community in a four-bedroom house with the typical new home amenities.
See, you can see the backyard there. We actually have some mountain views back here.
Richardson says they're willing to give up their big master suite and granite countertops in exchange for a less hectic lifestyle.
We understand the trade-offs, but a lot of days I'm getting home at 8 o'clock, 8:30, and the children are in bed. I almost always eat by myself, and we're looking to spend more time with family.
The Phoenix area has seen a handful of other housing projects start to come up near the new light rail line, which so far has attracted more riders than its planners had projected. But most of that housing takes the form of more traditional newly built condos or apartments. The idea of doing green renovations to foreclosed homes is one that's rarely been tried in any city, and one that will be tested when the Phoenix developers put the first of their older inner-city houses on the market next week. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.